that mountain, A-Town. Then I'm up in Chi-Town, or Miami shutting down. It's that New Orleans, it's L.A. or the Bay. It's New York, Philly, and the whole DMV. I'm a Detroit player, man, it's North-South Cats. Ohio, Pittsburgh, got St. Louis on deck. It's Delaware, Connecticut, it's New Jersey, got hella b****s. It's Queens, Brooklyn, and yeah, they rallying. Bronx, Harlem, and Staten Island.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the last 14 years, Give Guide has raised over $28 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Support KBOO and learn more about GiveGuide by going to kboo.fm/give. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations, too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, a majority of Republican senators are refusing to accept Joe Biden's presumptive win of the Electoral College and are acquiescing to Donald Trump's refusal to concede the presidency. As of Monday evening, the only GOP senators to have acknowledged Biden's presidential win were Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski. In remarks on Tuesday morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said this.
Until the Electoral College votes, anyone who's running for office can exhaust concerns about counting in any court of appropriate jurisdiction. It's not unusual. It should not be alarming. At some point here, we'll find out finally who was certified in each of these states, and the Electoral College will determine the winner, and that person will be sworn in on January 20th.
However, 4 years ago, when Mr. Trump won the Electoral College votes in razor-thin margins in key states, McConnell wasted no time in waiting for the official votes to be cast and said just days after that election that the results were, quote, clearly an indication the American people would like to try something new. Trump and his allies are claiming the election in 2020 was rigged and have legally challenged the results. When asked by reporters to provide evidence of the voter fraud that she and others have repeatedly alluded to, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany could not name a single one.
We're hearing these reports. We're seeing them come in. We are vetting them. We are getting affidavits. So right now, we would point you to all of that. That information is publicly available. But what we're asking for right now is patience as we explore these equal protection claims, among others.
On Monday, McEnany's claims of voter fraud sounded so dubious that even Fox News cut away from her remarks in disgust.
I just think we have to be very clear. She's charging the other side is welcoming fraud and welcoming illegal voting. Unless she has more details to back that up, I can't in good countenance continue showing you this. I want to make sure that maybe they do have something to back that up, but that's an explosive charge to make, that the other side is effectively rigging and cheating. If she does bring proof of that, of course, we'll take you back.
That's Fox News host Neil Cavuto cutting off a briefing by White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. On Monday, Attorney General William Barr handed federal prosecutors the authority to investigate claims of voter fraud, giving political weight to Trump's outlandish assertions. The move is typical for Barr, who has politicized his office for Trump's benefit. The move was so egregious that Richard Pilger, a man that the New York Times described as, quote, a career prosecutor in the department's public integrity section who oversaw voting fraud-related investigations, has now resigned, presumably in protest. Joining the partisan war, Republican state attorneys general are also signing on to help Trump after a group of them asked the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge a lower court ruling extending the mail-in ballot deadline in Pennsylvania. Some lawyers at the firms representing the Trump legal challenges are now reportedly uneasy over being part of an obviously politicized effort designed to erode trust in U.S. elections. Emily Murphy, a Trump appointee and the head of the General Services Administration, is still refusing to sign a letter formally authorizing the transition of power to Biden. There are national security implications over Murphy's refusal to authorize that transition, as Biden and his team have not been privy to presidential daily briefings or classified information. A bipartisan group of former Homeland Security secretaries signed an open letter saying that Trump's legal claims cannot and must not prevent the transition process from beginning. In Georgia, where an official winner has still not been declared, and where there are two Senate runoff races scheduled for January, there is major infighting within the GOP, as state officials pushed back against Trump's claims of voter fraud. The two Republican senators, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, who will face the runoffs, have asked Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to resign, saying he mismanaged the election. But Raffensperger said that is not going to happen. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution explained that the senator's move was, quote, a brazen effort to appease Trump, who has falsely claimed electoral fraud despite no evidence of any wrongdoing as he and his supporters try to discredit Biden. The AJC's reporters wrote, quote, we are told the president and his top allies pressured the two Republican senators to take this step, lest he tweet a negative word about them and risk divorcing them from his base ahead of the consequential runoff. Republican official Gabriel Sterling, who manages Georgia's voting system, dismissed the concerns of the two senators and President Trump, saying that claims of widespread voter fraud were, quote, fake news and disinformation, hoaxes and nonsense. Sterling said, don't buy into these things, find trusted sources. In other news, arguments were heard in the Supreme Court on Tuesday in the case against the Affordable Care Act. Donald B. Verrilli, Jr., who was President Barack Obama's Solicitor General, defended the case on behalf of the Democrat-controlled House. He said to justices, quote, in view of all that transpired in the past decade, the litigation before this court, the battles in Congress, the profound changes in our healthcare system, only an extraordinarily compelling reason could justify judicial invalidation of this law at this late date. The Republican Party has worked feverishly for a decade to overturn the health care law without offering an alternative other than returning to the pre-Obamacare normal when millions more Americans than now were uninsured or underinsured. Remarks by Justices John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh signaled their willingness to leave the law intact. Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden gave a speech defending the ACA on Tuesday. Lawyers that had been tasked by the government to locate the parents of 545 immigrant children separated by the Trump administration now say that number is higher. It turns out there are 666 children, and nearly 20% of them were under the age of 5 when they were first ripped out of their parents' care. While Trump claimed during the last presidential debate that his office was working hard to reunite the children with their parents, in truth, the government appears to be doing nothing. The lawyer representing the children has written to the Justice Department saying, quote, we would appreciate the government providing any available updated contact information or other information that may be helpful in establishing contact for all 666 of these parents, end of quote. And the Guatemalan Migration Institute has released a report showing that since the pandemic began, the U.S. has deported about 1,400 unaccompanied minors to Guatemala using the virus as justification. The former head of the Food and Drug Administration, Scott Gottlieb, warned that the pandemic is, quote, about to explode across the United States as massive numbers of new infections are documented each day and more than 10 million infections have been reported overall. Dr. Michael Osterholm echoed this assessment, saying, quote, we are about to enter COVID hell. Osterholm is a renowned infectious diseases expert and a member of Joe Biden's newly formed coronavirus task force. On Monday, there were nearly 60,000 hospitalizations of COVID-19 patients across the U.S., the largest number at any given time. In international news, Peru's President Martin Vizcarra has just been impeached by his Congress and faces a vote to remove him from office. A minority of Peruvians supported the impeachment and some are calling it a coup. Armenia has accepted an agreement with Azerbaijan, brokered by Russia in the violent conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh. According to the New York Times, quote, under the deal, the warring sides were to halt fighting and prepare for the peacekeepers' arrival. And finally, senior Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat has died of the coronavirus. Mr. Erekat was a prominent voice for Palestinian independence and was a confidant of Palestinian Authority leaders Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In the wake of the November 3rd, 2020 election, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is doing what he does best, obstruct, break norms, and ruthlessly play a game of politics that's best summarized as do as I say, not as I do. 4 years ago, McConnell wasted no time in congratulating President-elect Donald Trump, even before the official vote counts in states were tallied. Today, he has decided that media outlets like Associated Press, who do the careful math to project a winner accurately, are not the arbiters of the Electoral College. And so the nation must wait until President Trump has mounted his baseless legal challenges. McConnell has also played politics with the COVID-19 economic relief package, waiting until after the election to see how he could use the outcome to his ends. Now he is delaying the transition process to a Biden White House, using his leverage to determine Biden's cabinet appointments. My guest is Max Moran, research assistant at the Revolving Door Project, which is a project of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He just wrote the piece, We Don't Have to Live in Mitch McConnell's World, for the American Prospect. Welcome to the program, Max.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to how McConnell is trying to impact or influence Biden's cabinet appointments, what are you making of his hypocrisy on just the decision around the election? The world, much of the world, much of the country has accepted the fact that Joe Biden is the president-elect. It's basically how we do it every 4 years. But McConnell is enabling Trump, taking him seriously and validating his conspiracy theory that this was a rigged election.
Well, I think first and foremost that it's horrifying to see one of the most powerful figures in our country buy into these, or at least validate these conspiracy theories for the purpose of just temporarily trying to extend his own political power, or at least to stay allied with Donald Trump. I think that there's very little chance that their attempts to muddy the water here are ultimately successful in terms of helping Trump to hold on to his power. I don't think that they are sticking in any place outside of the far-right media ecosystem. But I also think that Joe Biden shouldn't forget that Mitch McConnell did not consider him to be, and frankly does not consider him to be, once he becomes the next president, to be a legitimate president. This speaks very directly to what McConnell's priorities are, and they are not on unity, they are not on actually governing the country in any way. It is purely a game for ultimate political power. Joe Biden has no reason to in any way take McConnell seriously or try to listen and work with McConnell if McConnell is not even going to consider him to be a legitimate president.
McConnell doesn't seem even in the least bit cowed by the fact that his hold on power is tenuous. He did win re-election, and he didn't just win it, he sailed through it. So maybe that has given him the hubris that he's acting with. Yet his hold on the Senate is not decided. There are two Senate races that will be taking place in Georgia on January 5th. And if Democrats win both of those races, with the White House in their pocket, McConnell will no longer be Senate Majority Leader. But he doesn't seem to be quite worried about that.
No, I mean, I'd say that he's certainly concerned about it. He's not the type to very openly display when he's worried or when he's concerned about things. I think that he's operating on the assumption that Democrats can't pull off the clean sweep here and is trying to stake out his ground and very clearly establish what has already been established, that he is the grim reaper of legislation, as they call him, a person who is entirely unwilling to really allow any sort of legislation whatsoever to pass through the Senate. So Democrats obviously should be devoting any and all resources that they have to trying to win those two seats. But if they don't, it's important for Democrats to also recognize that, one, they have alternatives to working with McConnell's Senate, and two, more importantly, more broadly, they don't have to play McConnell's game. They don't have to accept politics on the terms that Mitch McConnell wants them to accept them on.
So let's take a look at what we're already seeing, which are very worrying signs. Now, of course, Biden has won the election through a coalition of liberals and progressives and even anti-Trump Republicans. One could expect that perhaps his cabinet appointments might reflect some mix of the various parts of the political spectrum. But what have you seen? Have Biden's potential cabinet picks gone from progressive to centrist to even conservative as they see McConnell's intransigence? Because as Senate Majority Leader, McConnell would have the power to set votes on cabinet appointments and approve cabinet appointments.
Well, it's interesting because the early names that we've seen floated for at least some positions have been more progressive than you might expect from Joe Biden. He named Gary Gensler as his individual to be conducting a review of the financial regulatory agencies, for instance. Gary Gensler was quite progressive after the 2008 financial crisis as an individual surveying what happened in that particular crisis and trying to establish new rules of the road and new regulations on Wall Street. So in his initial names that we're seeing in rumors and so on, Biden's team seems like they're trying very hard to sort of thread a needle between the progressive wing and the centrist wing. And in so doing, they're obviously acknowledging that the progressive wing is both ascendant and an important and powerful player and plays an important role in his election, which is all true. What you are hearing, unsurprisingly, from lobbyists on K Street, from corporate America, and so on, is basically outright celebration at the notion of divided governments, because they figure that if McConnell controls the seats, then then the only way that Biden will be able to confirm any cabinet nominees is if they are centrist corporatists, if they are essentially allies of the people who bankroll McConnell himself. This obviously puts a kibosh on any of the big progressive policies which Biden did embrace over the course of the 2020 campaign. The fact of the matter is that that isn't true. Biden has alternative ways of filling out his cabinets. For one thing, he can use the Vacancies Act. This is a law that allows him to temporarily make civil servants, you know, career employees at these agencies into Treasury secretaries, into labor secretaries, and so on. And he can also use recess appointments. He can essentially try to force the Senate into a recess, which is a power that he has as president. And while the Senate is in recess, he can make these appointments and have them last until the end of the next congressional session. So basically, it lasts until the end of the next year. It's simply untrue that Mitch McConnell now controls all of the levers of power in Washington. And solely through his executive powers, Biden can still do quite a lot. It's simply a matter of him having the willpower to do so.
Would going that route essentially mean that the Democrats have to fall to McConnell and Trump's depths in order to get things done? Were these the same tools that Trump used? Although, of course, he had McConnell in his pocket throughout his presidency to do his bidding in the Senate.
You know, I think it's a complicated question because, yes, these are going to be violating certain norms of governance, but we already know and we can already see that the Republican Party violates norms of governance every day and as a basic part of its operating strategy.
But yet the Democrats love to give them the benefit of the doubt, hoping against hope, like a failed repeated experiment, that the Republicans will play by the rules. But the Republicans over and over again, at least over the past decade, have simply blown up the rules.
Precisely. And so what we're going to be living through right now is a period of 2 years in which it is absolutely crucial that Democrats basically get their act together and realize that the Republicans are never going to change their ways. This is the only way that the Republicans can hold on to power. If this country reflected the Democratic consensus of the people, the Republicans would never win a national election again. You know, so it's important for Democrats to recognize that, you know, there may be a symbolic victory in some people's eyes to follow the rules but to lose. But if you only win symbolic victories, that doesn't put food on the table. That doesn't give you access to healthcare. That doesn't stop the climate from warming. We don't want symbolic victories. The people absolutely need, in this crucial moment, actual victories. If that requires violating a few norms, all of which is perfectly legal, let's be clear, if that requires violating a few norms in order to actually assert and enact the policies for which Democrats were elected, they need to violate those norms. That's the only way that, one, they can hold on to power in 2022 and 2024. Much more importantly, that's the only way that we can even begin to address the incredible crises in front of us.
Now, where one falls on the answer to the question of what makes a Democrat electable really depends on your politics. The moderate slash centrist have decided that it's because of the progressives that the Democrats didn't win control of the Senate and expand control of the House and instead lost some House control. The progressives think it's the other way around.
I'd say that that's, you know, for one thing, there's always going to be arguments whenever there is an election between the progressive wing of the party and the centrist wing of the party. I think that if you just look at the raw numbers, it doesn't really make much sense, the centrist argument. Every swing state House representative who endorsed Medicare for All won re-election. The ones who lost re-election were ones who had not endorsed Medicare for All. Quite simply, the country is a lot more populist and the country is a lot more hungry for change than centrist politicians are willing to enact. And I think that one of the major takeaways of this election has to be that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi's essential theory of politics, the theory for which they intervened in primary challenges, the theory for which they blacklisted consulting firms that wanted to help out primary challengers, the theory of, like, the only way for Democrats to win is to run to the center or the center right and just sort of hope for the best, that theory has been proven entirely untrue. The Democrats failed to flip the Senate and the Democrats lost seats in the House. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have to own that.
It's incredible over the past 4 years to have seen Trump appointees that did get Senate confirmation hearings often win the votes of Democrats. I mean, the Republicans controlled the Senate for the past 4 years. They didn't need Democrats to vote on Trump appointees, but many Democrats did. I think perhaps the most egregious vote was the one to confirm Attorney General William Barr, which many Democrats joined in voting for. And now we see how unconscionable Barr's actions have been, how deeply he has politicized the DOJ. So those positions that the Republicans used to fill using the Vacancies Act, how did they champion the use of that act in a way that gives Democrats cover to use that same method going forward?
Well, the way that Republicans went about it, essentially all boils back down to the cult of personality around Donald Trump personally. Republicans were just frankly terrified of ever telling Donald Trump no for 4 years because they thought that that would cause them to lose their personal elections. What this means for Democrats is that Republicans have spent 4 years being entirely fine with use of recess appointments, which, by the way, presidents of both parties do all the time. Obama did over 100 of them. George Bush did over 100 of them. But the Republicans have been fine with use of the Vacancies Act for 4 years when they controlled the votes in order to confirm each and every one of these individuals. Trump was just too lazy and he didn't want to have to go through the work of the chance that someone would ask him a tough question on any of his appointees. So, you know, they are in no standing, in good faith at least, to in any way oppose use of the Vacancies Act or use of recess adjournments. Now, they're going to anyways because that's what Republicans do. The point is that Democrats, again, have to recognize that Republicans, most especially Mitch McConnell, are just incapable of acting in good faith. If they act in good faith, they will lose elections. So don't bother pretending like they're ever acting in good faith and do what you need to do in order to enact change, in order to help the people, and most importantly for the Democrats in the Senate, to win elections.
Would Biden's aggressive posturing with McConnell, you think, make the Democratic Party more viable in 2022?
Absolutely. If Biden, for one thing, aggressively appoints the people that he needs, and then two, through that, takes aggressive executive branch action, I think that's in fact the only path to a Democratic victory in 2022 and 2024. Look, you're not going to get any legislation, no matter how feeble, past Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell, let me remind you, is the man who said that it was his goal to make Barack Obama a one-term
president.
That's
right.
That was his goal in 2008.
And to overturn the Affordable Care Act, which is currently being heard by the Supreme Court, and even Precisely. Conservative justices now appear to be wanting to keep that law intact.
Precisely. So don't even begin trying to have some sort of a big legislative thing that you can bring back to the people in 2022 and 2024. It's simply not going to happen. You should still introduce those bills and you should still make a fight out of it. And you should still message aggressively when McConnell is being the obstructionist that he is. But that's not going to be the thing which you bring back to the people to show them that you deserve re-election. The thing that's going to be the thing that you bring back to the people is going to be aggressive executive action. Did you know, for instance, that you can cancel 95% of student loan debt with just two signatures from the Secretary of Education, or with just one signature, rather, because 95% of student loan debt is held by the federal government. So same as with any other debt that's held, the debt holder can just say, you know what, I don't care anymore if people pay this or not. If you do that, that is overnight a sea change, a transformation in the American economy. And I'd say more importantly, it shows people that the government can still do things to improve their lives. You can prosecute big pharma companies, big tech companies. You can do antitrust, do breakups. You can have aggressive EPA action. There's all kinds of things that you can do with laws that are already on the books that are all things that Joe Biden can do right from day one. It's just a matter of him choosing to do it.
So you have McConnell, who actually has a lot of political leverage, at least, you know, pending the results of the January 5th Georgia runoffs races. What is the force that you see, the political force that you see on the other side? Because, of course, we are in a moment where there's, you know, to sort of paraphrase Biden, who said that the election was a battle for the soul of the nation. Going forward, we're in a battle for the soul of Biden. And you have progressives on one side, and you have the ultra-right-wing Republicans on the other side who, unfortunately, are teaming up with centrists. So on the progressive side, do figures like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Squad and Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, do they have enough leverage, you know, and House Representatives Pramila Jayapal and the entire Congressional Progressive Caucus, do they have enough political leverage and the willpower to fight Biden and say, you've got to listen to us and not McConnell?
They have a significant amount of leverage and they have a significant amount of power because progressives are the ones who turn up. Progressives are the ones who are going to turn up in the streets. Progressives are the ones who are remaining engaged in politics, no matter who is in the White House, if it's Joe Biden, if it's whoever. And it's important to remember that also Joe Biden is he's not an ideological centrist in the way that someone like Pete Buttigieg is, like a deep believer in corporate power. No, Joe Biden is more of like a triangulator. He goes wherever the center of the party happens to be. And it's pretty clear the center of the party has been moving significantly to the left in recent years. Like, you know, when Joe Biden would say over and over, oh, I'm running on the most progressive platform of any candidate in recent history, he's not wrong about that. That's because the center of gravity, the center of what's considered acceptable to the Democratic Party has shifted significantly to the left in recent years. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pramila Jayapal, they control significant power. And it's also worth noting that Pramila Jayapal has said, she's the head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, that she is going to be reorganizing the caucus in order to have it wield more just raw electoral strength within the House, in order to stall on centrist bills, in order to force extractions and so on. And again, I really think it's worth reemphasizing that Schumer and Pelosi's entire model of politics deeply, deeply failed in this election. So if the Democrats are honest with themselves, which is an open question, about what this election means, they're going to have to think very carefully about whether they want to stake out those centrist positions anymore. In fact, you're already seeing this a lot with Chuck Schumer, who's pretty clearly terrified of a primary challenge from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in 2 years. He has been shifting significantly to the left, including on things like student debt forgiveness that I just mentioned. So, like, you know, progressives should not despair. They should get out in the streets and they should fight, is my basic message.
So I'm glad you brought up Chuck Schumer, because as Senate Minority Leader, he is in line to be Majority Leader if those two Senate races in Georgia are won by Democrats. And then again, we have the question of, just as will Biden play hardball with McConnell, would Chuck Schumer, as a potential Senate Majority Leader, play hardball? You know, it's easy to sound aggrieved when you're the leader of the minority party, but when you actually have power, how you wield it is all that matters.
That is true. And much like Biden, it's not Schumer's natural state to want to play hardball, to want to follow the mandate of his party, no matter what the folks across the aisle think. But I think that Schumer, in some ways even more so than Biden, is very open to being persuaded and is very open to being pushed in different directions. Again, in large part because he is terrified of a primary in 2024, or in 2022 rather, excuse me, either from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or from any number of other incredible progressives in New York City. So, like, again, the fact of the matter is that it's going to be a difficult 2 years, a difficult 4 years ahead. But if progressives continue organizing, if progressives continue mobilizing in the way that they have over the last 4 years towards the goals that we have in mind, they can actually win on a lot of things. The tides are shifting in the progressive direction. It's just a matter of keeping up the fight.
I'm wondering if you have any insight as to Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. There are plenty of reports indicating that as Biden's vice president, she would be taking a much larger, more active role than traditionally vice presidents have taken, simply because Biden has already said he wants to be a one-term president, and she's likely his successor. And she's another one of these sort of Obama-like figures who is not staunchly progressive, nor is she staunchly centrist or a conservative Democrat.
Yeah, we certainly have concerns about Harris's strong ties to the big tech companies, much more so than Joe Biden does. Joe Biden has never been a deep lover of Silicon Valley in the same way that Barack Obama was. Harris obviously came up in California politics. When you come up in California politics, there's very few ways to do that without building some ties to big tech. Her campaign manager of her first run for California Attorney General is now one of the top lobbyists at Google. So we're concerned about that. We also know that Harris is, you know, an ambitious figure, a figure who can see which ways the winds are blowing. And I, this is again me speaking very personally, I would not necessarily put her in that same sort of like deeply ideologically centrist in the way of like a Pete Buttigieg type of figure. I would say that she is open to being persuaded. She is open to hearing different perspectives. I think she's someone that we'll have to keep a close eye on. We'll also have to see just, again, exactly how a Biden administration ends up both staffing itself out and just sort of organizing itself internally, exactly how much power and on what specific issues Kamala Harris ends up taking over. But, you know, Biden himself, of course, came up as a vice president. He wants his vice president to take an activist role. So we'll have to see what happens.
And another side note, since I'm in California, and speaking of Kamala Harris, California Governor Gavin Newsom is the one who gets to pick Harris's replacement as California senator, and who he picks to replace her in the Senate, you know, could strengthen progressives' hands in the Senate if he picks somebody who is a strong progressive. There's a number of people on the short list, including Alex Padilla. Some have even mentioned Representative Barbara Lee and Karen Bass. So we'll certainly see how that plays out. Where's a good place for people to read your work and your writings, Max?
Sure. You can check me out at therevolvingdoorproject.org. That's therevolvingdoorproject.org. I would also strongly recommend checking out the American Prospect's Day One Agenda. That is the Day One Agenda at the American Prospect.
We'll link to both of those from our website. Max, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Max Moran, research assistant at the Revolving Door Project, which is a project of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His latest article, just published in the American Prospect, is called We Don't Have to Live in Mitch McConnell's World. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Green Party of the U.S. did not fare well in this year's presidential election. Unlike 4 years ago, the Green presidential nominee for president, Howie Hawkins, garnered fewer votes than the margin of difference between the two major party candidates in states where he was on the ballot. But the most well-known progressive third party can count on one major victory at a local level. Green Party member Emmanuel Estrada, a 26-year-old with working class and immigrant roots, unexpectedly won the race for mayor of the town of Baldwin Park in Southern California. He now joins me to discuss his candidacy and win. Welcome to the program, Emmanuel.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, tell me about your relationship with the Green Party and what your how it informed the platform that you ran on as a candidate for mayor.
Yeah, so I learned about the Green Party in 2016. And, you know, it was interesting to see a party that was really...
So you were only 22 years old then?
Yeah, I was around 22 years old. You know, I've been super excited about elections since I was maybe like 18. So, you know, when I turned 18, I thought it was so exciting to vote. I don't know if, you know, that's the that's the norm with 18-year-olds, but that was kind of what happened with me. So I've been I've tried to be very involved in politics. And, you know, I found out about the Green Party and I thought it was so exciting how there's a party that's practically self-funded, right? It's self-reliant. It's individual contributions, individual efforts. And And I thought that was exciting. It was exciting to know that these things are possible.
So how did you, the Green Party's values inform your platform? And you know, why did you choose the Green Party instead of, say, the Democratic Party?
So one way to put it, and I tell everybody is you know, you walk into Baskin Robbins or something, they got 31 flavors of ice cream. You know, why do you have only two choices in politics? You know, to me, politics is a spectrum. You know, there's different ways to go about things. There's different ideas. It's not black and white. You know, it's not the way we've been kind of, you know, taught to think about it. There's multiple avenues, especially when it comes to issues and platform and philosophy. You know, I am supportive of stuff that goes on in other parties and whatnot, but I just felt it was like I said, it was intriguing to see that it was such a grassroots effort, really.
Tell me about Baldwin Park and the issues that you ran on. I understand that there hasn't been a change in leadership for a long time.
Yeah, so Baldwin Park is a 7 square mile city. It's a suburb of Los Angeles. You know, where the average family, where the average household wage is around $62,000. You know, I came to Baldwin Park at a young age. I guess in short, I really love this city. It's, you know, it's a young city. There's people here who have generations. You know, some of these family lines go beyond, you know, the incorporation of the city. And so, you know, to me, this city is very special, and I want to make sure that it stays, you know, that it stays Baldwin Park. You know, I ran on the issues that we can make a more equitable city, that we can make cities that benefit everybody, and that develop for the community and not at the expense of the community. You know, so we ran on things like, how can we make a healthier city? We know that, you know, data tells us that it's not your genetics or, you know, your family tree that's going to decide how healthy you're going to be or how long you're going to live or how successful you're going to be. It's your zip code, you know, and it's very important that we fight those statistics and that we change them for the better. You know, especially when these communities are large populations of immigrant and people of color and things like that. You know, I really wanted to change things at the local level. I really believe that change is going to happen here. I believe that local government is where it's at.
Now, one of the issues that I see that you ran on was affordable housing. Californians voted on a proposition that would have enacted rent control, but they voted against it. How important is the issue of affordable housing in Baldwin Park, and how do you as mayor plan to address it?
I think it's very important. I think everybody has to realize that housing and stable housing is a foundation to a healthy and stable life. You know, if you don't have housing, you're not going to have anything else. To me, housing is important. As I mentioned before, we are a community that's heavily populated by immigrants, and I want to see them succeed. I want to see everybody succeed. I think you know, I think housing is a human right. I think we all have, we should have a fair opportunity to attain housing. When it comes to housing, we've talked about changing the way we look at housing. There's this idea that if we allow for-profit developers to develop as much as they want, that somehow you know, that's going to change things, and I don't believe that's the case. I want to focus on nonprofit developers and getting creative with housing. You know, not
so
just
will you be regulating developers more?
I would like to see that. I would like to see you know, municipalities have a lot of power, and I've that's one of the things that I ran on, that municipalities and local government can do a lot more when it comes to ordinances and local laws, and I think that's important. I personally don't believe in blanket statements. I don't believe in one law is going to benefit everybody. So at a more local level, we can create a more custom approach. And I would want to get, you know, dig in and see how we can do that.
The other issue that I see that you also ran on was just local economics. We are at a very difficult time nationally, but also statewide. State budgets are grappling with the loss of revenues due to the pandemic. Local city budgets are also struggling. And of course, individuals are struggling deeply with millions of jobs lost. How does a Green Party platform and you as a mayor take on the issue of building an economy that works for everybody?
So here at the local level, my platform is about the local economy. And so we know that things are changing, right? We, you know, when you talk to the average person, they want to see development, but they, you know, they think that, you know, these big name brands are going to be the answer. And I don't believe so. You know, looking at the current times, e-commerce is destroying corporate retail, right? They're struggling to keep up. I think the approach to that is create something organic and viable. Make something that's going to want to make people shop in your area. What's going to make it differentiate from, going to the neighboring city or shopping at their location? And I think local economics does that. Not only that, but we also have to consider, the data. When you shop local, when you buy from a local business owner or from a local business, you are helping circulate the money in your economy. So if I go and I shop corporate where there's stakeholders, and those stakeholders don't live in our city, what happens is that, a lot of that money is going to get funneled out.
So as mayor, what would you do to encourage local small mom and pop businesses to be more viable than corporate chains? What can you do as a mayor to do that?
I think we have to really change the image of the city and help promote, our small businesses. One of the most important things is hear these local business owners out and try to understand what's stopping them from growing or what sort of aid do they need and what can, the city do to help them out. I've always said that, when you're trying to help a certain group of people, you have to hear them out, and they have to be, they have to have a seat at the table when it comes to programs that are going to benefit them. So that's one of the things I'm looking forward to, really building a connection with the community and really getting to know a lot of these people.
How did you convince the residents of Baldwin Park to choose you over the longtime incumbent Manuel Lozano, who was the earlier mayor of Baldwin Park?
I think a lot of people were ready for change. I think, I personally think that when I campaign and when I talk about things, I'm very honest about stuff. I look at these opportunities as platforms. I always look at these as whether we win or not, what did we achieve? Were we able to talk about issues that mattered? Were we able to talk about things that people wanted to hear? Did we give a voice to people that otherwise wouldn't have a voice, if we didn't run? A lot of candidates stick to certain issues, and we try to really use this platform to talk about the things and how they affect us. And I think, a lot of people like that. I think there's a younger generation that's becoming more able to vote, and they're of age now, and I think they were excited as well. A lot of people want change, and I think we were able to bring in a new perspective.
Do you consider yourself a staunch progressive?
I guess so. I really want to see progress. I want to see change. I want to see a more equitable city and a more equitable community. I would believe progressive is a good term.
How do you respond to the fact that during this presidential race, of course, there was so most attention placed on the top part of the ticket, and then, of course, the Senate and the House races. But I think a lot of people were sort of surprised at how folks that look and sound like you and that have a name like yours, who are Latino Americans, actually, chose the side of a virulently right-wing party, the Republican Party, over, say, the Democratic Party, or even something closer to the platform you stand for. I'm wondering why you think that's the case, where even folks who are of immigrant background ended up choosing an anti-immigrant president.
I don't know. I think, when you look at people and when you hear them out, a lot of them are single-issue voters, and they might not care about certain topics as long as it doesn't affect them. We know that in these times, everything's polarized. So if somebody is on one issue and that's their most important issue, they're going to go with that candidate. It's unfortunate, but I think that as voters, we do have to do our best to be informed and try to understand how everything comes together and affects us. Some candidates just weren't as enticing, or some as exciting, and I think that was another issue.
You think that Biden didn't generate enough excitement among Latinos, or among enough Latinos?
Yeah, I don't believe so. I think they could have done a little bit more. I tried to look at the platform and things like that, and I didn't really see anything that was too exciting. When you look at when Obama ran, everybody was excited. I was one of those people, I'm not gonna lie. There wasn't a lot of excitement about this campaign, I think, and that was one of their issues.
Are you hopeful that more young people will run for local offices, and especially run on the Green Party platform for local offices like you? I mean, often the Green Party has come under criticism for, not starting small and just going, focusing a lot of energy on presidential races. There's been a lot of finger pointing around, being a spoiler party. for presidential races. And of course, there have been people that have run for local races, but not enough or not many have actually won local race elections. And, you know, unlike yourself, do you hope that your win as mayor of a small town in Southern California will encourage more people in the Green Party to run for local office and build from there?
Yeah, I mean, just in general, I'm hopeful that more people will get involved. I mean, a little bit about the campaign. You know, I ran in 2018. That was my first time running. You know, I had $4,000 and this idea that we could make big changes at the municipal level. That the change that we want to see doesn't start anywhere else but here at home. You know, 2 years later, we have over half of the vote, and you know, we have an opportunity to do that. I really want to see everybody take a chance and get involved and speak their mind. Everybody, and I mean everybody, is more than capable of running. You know, we need to change the way we look at elections. You know, somebody's fancy degree or, you know, their nice job title or, you know, however well they're doing and on a socioeconomic level, none of that is going to translate into good intentions for everybody else. And we need to understand that. And so there is nobody more qualified than the person in that community to speak up, you know, that's what qualifies you, I believe. You know, if you want to run for a local government and you're a member of that community and you're well aware of what's going on and what needs to change, you have every right to speak up. As for, you know, third parties running, I do believe that they should focus more on small elections. I believe this is where the playing field is more level. I've always said that. Unfortunately, people are not aware of this, but third party candidates have to keep running these races in order to keep ballot status. You know, we've seen a lot of laws change at state and federal levels, and they've made it very hard for these parties to
That's right, including in California. There's, you know, a few years ago, a ballot proposition that won that effectively crippled third-party races, third-party candidates to run for certain offices. Yeah.
Yes, that's correct.
So finally, how can people find out more about what you're doing? I imagine there's a lot of people that are going to be watching. What sort of mayor a Green Party candidate becomes? Is there a Twitter feed or just a website for the mayor's office in Baldwin Park?
I don't believe so. But there, you know, I believe you go on the Baldwin Park website. You know, once all this becomes more official and things, you will be able to maybe see my biography. But if you want to stay in contact with me, you want to reach out to me, or you want to follow along on our exciting journey, you can do so by following on Instagram and Twitter at estradaformayor.com, that's the website. But Twitter handle and Instagram handle is at estradaformayor.
That's at Estrada for Mayor. We'll post a link to that from our website later today. Emmanuel, good luck to you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Emmanuel Estrada, Baldwin Park, California's 26-year-old newly elected mayor and a member of the Green Party. We've been discussing his electoral win and Green Party politics. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage across the United States in higher than ever numbers, the government of Donald Trump still has no plan to tackle the virus beyond waiting for a vaccine. Today, as President-elect Joe Biden forms a coronavirus task force and waits in vain for Trump to concede the election, we'll share a mini documentary by our partners at Brave New Films on preventable COVID-19 deaths and how they've impacted the surviving communities.
My name is Vivian Light Johnson, and I live in Ocoee, Florida.
My name is Janice Johnson, and I live in Detroit, Michigan.
I'm originally from Michigan. In our family, we had four brothers. There was me and two sisters, and Joyce is in the middle of the sisters.
My mother's name is Joyce Ann Davis.
Joyce, early on, started having hearing challenges.
Single mother, raised two hearing kids.
My sister was able to graduate from high school. She got her teaching degree. She taught in the school for the deaf, and then she went back and she got her master's degree. She was able to get out and start advocating for the deaf community, so she was so excited about this. She spoke at several different groups, even to conferences, which made it even more sad when she got COVID, because she was just beginning to find her voice.
The days leading up to my daughter and I taking her to the hospital, we noticed that she was having some difficulty catching her breath.
She couldn't get off the bed to get to the bathroom.
So that's when I knew something wasn't right.
She first got sick like mid-March.
We were not aware of the coronavirus.
In February, when they first started talking about COVID, it was intermittent.
Even me being in the healthcare field, I did not know about the coronavirus, but she did get tested while she was in the ER. It came back positive.
When they dropped her off, they couldn't stay because of COVID.
I was so scared. I could not eat. I couldn't sleep. I barely functioning at work. During her hospital stay, she was very upset because, like I said, she is deaf.
Other deaf people had to share an interpreter.
They would send an interpreter probably once a day.
They were not always there when the doctors came in. That was the most traumatic part, knowing that my sister couldn't communicate and that she had no understanding of really what was going on.
She was scared. She felt like, in her exact words, they're gonna kill me. And she told me she wasn't gonna make it home.
None of us knew that she was really that sick.
She was not responding to any treatments. Her organs were failing. The hospital allowed me, my brother, and my children to come say our goodbyes. She did not pass while we were there. She waited till we got home, and that's when I got the call.
And she passed away the 22nd.
My mother was my best friend. She was all I had. It was so hard for me that I wanted to go to sleep and not wake up.
There's a lot of unnecessary grief and tragedy that we're going through.
It hurts because she was not ready.
Well, the sad thing is that our government wasn't dealing with it.
I think it's under control. It is what it is.
And I live in a state that follows that leadership. So we're getting a double whammy.
He was safe because he knew about this virus.
This is deadly stuff. I wanted to always play it down.
That was the day that I went into full-blown grief, because here's a president who said he could kill people on Fifth Avenue and he'd get away with it. He didn't even have to go to Fifth Avenue. He could sit right in his office, and he's killing people every day.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
Are you kidding me? Every day you're causing confusion and anxiety. I just can't buy this whole line of, I didn't want to cause panic. No, you didn't care. As a society, we believe they're throwaway people. And usually they're black and brown people.
It is so important to me to go to the poll and vote, because I want my vote counted.
That's a short film produced by our partners at Brave New Films on preventable COVID-19 deaths. and how they've impacted the surviving communities. We'll post a shareable link to that video on our website. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? I look around and all I see, masked faces staring at me. Keep your distance, don't touch me. Get your hands off my teepee. Somebody save my sanity.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Is your organization